Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Life and Death at Abbey Gate, The Fall of Afghanistan in the Operation to Save Our Allies by Michael Cook with Robert Conlon. Narrated by Michael Cook. This book is dedicated to our Afghan allies who stood next to us for 20 long years of war, who were promised protection, then left behind. To the 13 American heroes who made the ultimate sacrifice at Abbey Gate, Hamid Karzai International Airport, your courage and humanity will never be forgotten. Thank you for helping save my friends. Foreword. When Tom Schumann called me in April 2021, I detected a sense of desperation in his voice that unsettled me. A proven combat leader with steady resolve, Tom led patrols in Afghanistan's deadly Helmand Valley in 2011 while he served in 3rd Battalion, 5th Marine Regiment, the famed Dark Horse Battalion. There he confronted unspeakable horrors among the deadliest fighting in the U.S. Marine Corps' storied history. In all the time I had known him, Tom was not one to let his emotions shake his constitution. This was different. Tom needed my help. Over the next few moments, Tom explained to me the meticulous efforts he had already made over the course of years to secure a special immigration visa for his former Afghan interpreter, Zach. Through the cauldron of combat, Tom had forged a bond with Zach that was indistinguishable from a family tie. They were brothers. He would sacrifice anything for Zach, and Zach would do the same for him. After he painstakingly exhausted all official channels through the U.S. State Department, Tom explained that the Taliban were now hunting Zach and his family as they perilously trekked through back channels in Afghanistan on their way to Kabul. Tom thought that my training as a lawyer and my dedication to duty as a fellow Marine would prove a potent combination to create a miracle out of an impossibly desperate situation. The unspoken truth between us was that if we failed, Zach and his family would die. Nearly every day for the next 4 months, we worked in a methodical manner. We wrote letters to elected officials, completed government documents, filed appeals, spoke to reporters, consulted immigration experts, and filled social media with posts that could be shared with a growing number of concerned service members and young veterans. We experienced some success, receiving endorsements for our efforts and for Zach's service to the United States from key leaders in the administration. But what neither of us could anticipate was that we would soon repeat this process over and over in unimaginable and quickening succession without achieving our goal, bringing Zach and his family to safety. As we talked, the world watched with white knuckles as the Taliban corralled thousands of desperate Afghans in and around the Hamid Karzai International Airport, HKIA, during those harrowing days in August 2021. Our process, however imperfectly created during that fateful summer, would soon ripple across a community of patriots who believed in an unspoken obligation and duty to our Afghan partners. Rarely in one's life will a person truly understand what they are capable of accomplishing. In his classic book, Profiles in Courage, John F. Kennedy remarked, "Great crises produce great men." It is under the highest pressures that one's training and character are revealed, or at least stripped of the veneer of modern life. In this book, you will not only learn of the extraordinary efforts of Digital Dunkirk, an effort no less epic in its scale and impact than that of the remarkable Brits that etched its namesake into history books in 1940, but you will learn of the impact of the finest men and women this nation has to offer. The Marines, soldiers, and sailors who bravely defended our country's greatest ideals and snatched desperate Afghans from the jaws of Taliban terrorists are precisely the people whose stories must be told by our generation. In an era so desperately in need of heroes, this book provides the listener with many. But why were so many moved to act? How could they sense their efforts would matter? After all, Digital Dunkirk mobilized a community that transcended the ranks of our veteran community. The British civilian fishing boats of 1940 were replaced with an instrument of immeasurable power, capable of orchestrating full-scale evacuation operations from half a world away, the smartphone. Anyone with an iPhone was capable of rowing towards the digital shore in Kabul to help, and they did. So maybe it was merely access that made it easier to provide help. However, in my estimation, the call to act and the outpouring of genuine support originated in a much more fundamentally important way. Pondering over this for the last year, I came to realize there's an even more captivating moral that comes to life within Life and Death at Abbeygate. That is that sometimes our most impressive achievements are the result of collaborative effort, of which we have little knowledge at the time and might never fully comprehend our impact. Arguably, no organization in history has successfully harnessed the spirit of unity, of purpose, more than the professional military. From our codependency of the Roman phalanx to the modern code of conduct, as service members, we fundamentally believe we are each other's keepers in every sense of the word. Determined to tell the story of Digital Dunkirk and the exceptional heroism at Abbeygate, Michael Cook pored over numerous accounts of those efforts, interviewed dozens of individuals with firsthand knowledge, and pulled together a crucial timeline of events in order to fully demonstrate the impact. In this book, Michael highlights the story most of us who were part of the effort knew had to be told. Maybe it is a failure to grasp the interwoven web and rippled effects of our actions, or maybe our group, which consists mostly of service members, have been bred to simply accept that we were doing our duty for which no special plaudits are required. In the end, the task of telling our story and placing it upon the mantle to be appropriately judged has begun. Did we measure up to the crisis? A former great citizen soldier once offered that the United States has two fundamental powers: the power of intimidation toward our enemies and the power of inspiration towards our friends. No better friend, no worse enemy. Each of us believed then, as we believe now, that we were acting consistently with our policies and expectations of our oath and the administration's promise to keep faith with our partners and allies. Through all modern conflict's complexity, our imperative is not simply to win, it is to win with honor. That is, to maintain legitimacy, the moral high ground in victory. Military forces must be legitimate if they are to be effective. Reputation matters. Adding to the challenge, professional military forces must be legitimate both in the conduct of their operations and in the perception of that conduct by numerous disparate, interconnected audiences around the world. No matter how our enemies attempt to weaponize our adherence to our principles, even when we fall short, we act in a manner that acknowledges, for all time, ours is the greatest nation the world has ever known. Life and Death at Abbeygate is published at a time when our nation sits at a crossroads. Partisan rancor rules the day and stifles meaningful progress. Similarly, the U.S. military, not actively engaged in combat operations for the first time in 2 decades, now epitomizes the criticisms of a garrison force, underemployed and infighting over its identity and future design. Yet, here emerges a story that confirms it is worth it. It being the ethos and principles upon which the United States has forged its reputation. Life and Death at Abbeygate demonstrates, in a deeply personal account, how each of us can make a difference. This book serves as a stark example to the entire world that there's nothing that Americans are incapable of doing when we work together. In those values we share and cultivate as Americans, we can, in measurable ways, have deep and lasting impacts on our entire world. It symbolizes that there is literally nothing that can stop an American committed to a just cause. As you listen to this book, and many like it that should be written, you will be struck by two interrelated realizations. First, that you are capable of more than you know, so go for it. Second, that our nation's best days are still ahead of us, so long as we remain true to our founding principles and work together. If you doubt either, Life and Death at Abbeygate will convince you. Christopher Davis, Washington, D.C., July 2023. Prologue, Abbeygate, Hkia. Break, break, break. The encrypted signal chat room I was logged into the morning of August 25th, 2021, barked out the universal military command to stand down and pay attention because something important was about to come through. Again. I slumped in my chair at my computer desk in Southeast Michigan and watched in an exhausted stupor as the ongoing drama that's come to be known as Digital Dunkirk played out on the screen. Reports of S-Vest, suicide vest, en route to Abbeygate. When I first saw a message like this days before, I felt my blood run cold. But by this point, I had barely slept in 4 days, and this was yet another report of a possible suicide vest attack at the most crowded gate at the Hamid Karzai International Airport, Hekaya, in Kabul, Afghanistan. Safe in my own house 7,000 miles away, I could choose to ignore the danger. I could close my eyes and drift off while the chat room lit up, but I didn't. I had made a life-or-death promise to my Afghan friends, Abdul and Mohammed, to help get them out of the country, and sleep was not an option. So I fought back the waves of fatigue and refocused. This chaotic, ongoing evacuation of American citizens and our Afghan allies was extremely personal to every Afghanistan campaign veteran in America, and I was no exception. The fact that my Afghan friends were in the midst of this crisis intensified that feeling even more. The Marines of 2nd Battalion, 1st Marine Regiment, 2-1, who manned the gate, didn't have the luxury of giving in to their exhaustion or ignoring the overwhelming stench of human waste and death, or the cries of despair from mothers holding their terrified children while they were engaged in the largest and most chaotic civilian evacuation in U.S. history. They also had to contend with the threat of an attack by an enemy both seen and unseen. In the days leading up to August 26, 2021, the command post at Hekaya issued 60 credible reports of potential ISIS-K suicide bombers roaming the perimeter of the airport, intent on having one last crack at killing Americans before they left Afghanistan forever. They would be happy to take any Afghans fleeing in terror with them as well. To them, these Afghans weren't countrymen. They were infidels. The threat reports were increasing with frequency as the clock ticked towards August 31, midnight deadline for the official Taliban takeover of the country and everything and everyone in it. By the 25th, the sixth sense in the digital Dunkirk chat seemed to morph from dread to resigned fatalism. It seemed like it was just a matter of time, the fifth trigger pull of a six-shot revolver in a game of Russian roulette. As they worked to keep the increasingly desperate crowds from storming the airfield again and putting a halt to the massive evacuation effort, Sergeant Ethan Zielinski and his squad from 2-1 Weapons Company were laser-focused on trying to prevent an IED incident. But their attention was being pulled in every direction at the same time. For one, their mission of strictly providing security at the gate had evolved into a multi-pronged effort that included non-lethal crowd control, threat recognition, and the attention-consuming and dangerous job of screening which Afghans were eligible for the golden ticket to America that they were risking their lives and the lives of their family to get. This necessary proximity didn't allow the Marines to establish a buffer zone to help mitigate any threats. The sound of gunshots rang out in staccato bursts constantly as Taliban gunmen, who manned an outer checkpoint that led to the main gate, fired into the air to harass and intimidate the terrified crowd. The Marines, some of whom had combat experience battling the Taliban on previous deployments, found themselves in the surreal position of standing nearly shoulder to shoulder with their former foes to accomplish the mission. Abdul Hadi Hamdan, a Taliban commander leading troops at Hekaya, claimed to have over 1,000 fighters wearing suicide vests patrolling the airport. Sergeant Zielinski watched one of them intently as the military-aged male fidgeted with a cell phone connected to what appeared to be wires leading into his chest rig. The rules of engagement prevented him from reacting unless there was an imminent threat to the Marines. He watched as the man melted away in the crowd. Sergeant Tyler Vargas Andrews, a sniper from 2-1 Weapons Company, had a military-aged male who fit the description of the bomber sighted in his scope. He requested permission to engage from his battalion commander after the psychological operations team confirmed the target, but the request was denied. All of this would have been daunting even if they had been trained for it. These were United States Marines, one of the most, if not the most, highly trained and lethal fighting forces in the world. Of course they had trained for the mission. They trained for everything. Not Sergeant Zielinski's weapons company. In the plane on the way over from Ali Al Salim Air Base in Kuwait City, he heard some other companies talking about the non-lethal crowd control training they received. But his five-member team, an 81-millimeter mortar squad, had gotten last-minute orders to come from Kuwait, where they had been deployed since April. Their training for this once-in-a-generation mission, a chaotic mass evacuation of American non-combatants and their allies in a hostile environment, which hadn't been seen since the fall of Saigon in 1975, had been fairly minimal due to the expedited timing. To make up for the short workup time, they conducted drills on the tarmac while waiting for the plane. As they monitored radio traffic about suicide bomb threats and pushed back the crowd, they also juggled cell phone calls and texts from American veterans, politicians, and people connected to them. NGO, non-governmental organization, officials, and a hodgepodge of frantic, faceless people. The messages were a variation of the same theme. My interpreter or other support personnel is at the gate with his family. The Taliban will kill them if they're discovered. Please help me get them out. The Marine would climb up on the canal wall, a Jersey barrier, or any elevated position within Abbey Gate sector and look out into the mass of humanity and try to spot these people. Thousands of people filled every inch of available space. Some waved identifying handwritten placards or a colorful scarf, anything to help distinguish them. Others didn't. It could be like looking for the proverbial needle in a haystack. If that wasn't difficult enough, it didn't help that an EOD, Explosive Ordnance Disposal team, was blanketing the Abbey Gate sector with electronic jamming signals, which would block a remote control detonation but were useless against self-detonating suicide vest bombs. The devices interrupted cell phone connections, causing many of the long-distance calls to drop, and whatever progress might have been made between the caller on one end and the Marine on the other to drop with them. The Taliban were also using jamming devices in an attempt to cause more disruption. On paper, they were supposed to be providing security to allow the evacuation to flow unimpeded until the deadline. But Sergeant Zelensky and others noted the sadistic glee some of them displayed in their new role as conquerors. They would see evidence of this too many times to count. If the hand of fortune kept the phone line open and provided a Marine a confirmed visual of the targets, they still needed to wade into the crowd to get them. Check to see if they had the correct paperwork, which constantly changed depending on the latest orders from the State Department, and then get them back through the resentful crowd at the gate and processing center at the PAX terminal. I didn't know any of these details when my friend Abdul handed his phone to Sergeant Ethan Zelensky from Elmhurst, Illinois. All I knew was that Abdul, Mohammed, their five wives, and five young children, all under the age of eight, had made it to Abbey Gate after a harrowing journey from a Kabul neighborhood. But that was only half the battle. Now that they were there, I still had to get them past the gate, in the airport, and on a plane. When Abdul handed the phone to Zelensky, they were wedged into a shit-filled sewage canal in between a wall of humanity. The Marines stood on a wall above them. It was almost exactly the spot where the very next day an ISIS bomber would pull the trigger and detonate a bomb that killed 13 American troops and over 170 Afghan civilians. The day before, Abdul didn't know Sergeant Zelensky, and Zelensky didn't know him. When I identified myself over the bulky phone line, I didn't know Sergeant Zelensky, and he didn't know me. Yet here we are, close to 2 years later, telling the story together. This is our story. It's also the story of U.S. Army Specialist Bismillah Paiman and his family, who bravely dodged the Taliban for a month before finding their way to America. It's the story, too, of Sergeant Jose Ramirez, Sergeant Casey Williamson, Lance Corporal Caden Baer, and Corporal Corey Moore, all 2-1 Marines who faithfully manned their posts at the hell that's known as Abbey Gate, and are willing to relive the experience to convey their story through their eyes. It's a story about the courage, fortitude, and sacrifice of the U.S. service members who died, and the ones who survived and still carry the physical and emotional scars of that mission. It's not the story of a shameful American betrayal of our Afghan allies, or unbelievably inept bureaucracy, or political finger-pointing. Plenty of others have and will tell that story, and will bend the narrative to fit their agenda. All of it happened, but that's not the story I'm telling. This story is also about the Afghan allies who endured incredible hardships in the hopes of building a life in the United States. As a result of my involvement, there are 20 of them living free of fear in our country now. Of the millions of Afghans who had this dream, they are the lucky ones. As depressing as the details of this story can be sometimes, that's the silver lining I can never forget. Last, but not least, this is the story about the spontaneous act of human decency, unflagging determination, and American ingenuity that came to be known as Digital Dunkirk. For the hundreds of people who poured their blood, sweat, and tears into helping evacuate 124,000 people in 15 days, this is your story too. Preface: What was Digital Dunkirk? Even today, nearly 2 years after it happened, I'm still almost at a loss for words when I try to describe what it was like to take part in Digital Dunkirk. But it's not an option to be at a loss for words when you're writing a book about the subject, so I'll do my best to explain it. Let's start with my biggest takeaway. Digital Dunkirk restored my faith in humanity. With all the divisiveness in the United States today, much of which is promoted, exploited, and spread on the same digital platforms that made Digital Dunkirk possible, it's still incredible to me that so many people with such different backgrounds and beliefs could rally together to achieve the impossible. The group's name, Digital Dunkirk, was inspired by the historic World War II evacuation effort when hundreds of British civilian boats assisted the British Royal Navy in evacuating Allied troops in danger of annihilation by the German army from the French beaches of Dunkirk. In total, 338,226 troops were rescued and brought back to England. This time around, we didn't have boats nor beaches, and we weren't saving our own troops. We had cell phones, computers, and social media, and we were saving our Afghan friends. The fact that it happened completely organically, with no command structure or hierarchy, and there was hardly any evidence of ego or self-promotion, made it seem like some kind of fairy tale about a lost civilization where people put their own needs aside and went above and beyond to help others in need because it was just and worthy. Many of us found ourselves entering the group in the same fashion, by accident. Most of us tried the proper government channels, filling out the required paperwork, only to be told, just have them shelter in place for now. But this mission was personal for most of us, and we knew that wasn't the solution. These were our friends' lives, and they were being hunted by a brutal enemy. So we set up shop on the internet. We started assembling teams of anyone and everyone who could help. From alphabet soup entities such as CIA and NSA agents, to military veterans who served in Afghanistan, to congressional staffers, and many more. Individually, we brought little more than the name of the Afghans we wanted to help and our varied experience and skills, but collectively we formed a formidable army. It was all these people dropping everything in their life for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and more to get this done, with almost no sleep the whole time, because falling asleep might mean an urgent missed message between them and a facilitator on the other end in Kabul. Cat naps with one eye open became the default sleeping method. We started setting up TOCs, tactical operation centers, and creating message threads on encrypted messaging apps such as Signal to pass information. Group members might have been texting and talking with someone on the ground at HKIA, drawing on constantly updated intel and resources out in the dozens of dedicated chat rooms to provide updated information on gates that may have just closed, or routes to avoid Taliban patrols, or visual signals to use to get the attention of a Marine at a gate. Or they could have been talking with a Marine at HKIA, trying desperately to reach across the thousands of miles that separated them to give them some nugget of information that could help them identify and then escort the person or persons they were trying to help. They may have been reaching across their own network of personal and professional connections to find someone with information on available charter flights, on what it took to get on a flight manifest, on special immigrant visa SIV document requirements, on family eligibility, or on what other countries might be accepting applicants. Or they might have been involved in raising money for those charter flights, or finding pilots to fly them and crews to help the hundreds of exhausted people when they finally boarded them. Maybe they were talking with congressional aides in D.C. or contacts at the State Department or DHS to try to get help. Or they heard about an NGO that had a valuable high-level contact and chased the tiger's tail until they found them or exhausted themselves trying. If anyone had a breakthrough or discovered a workaround, they'd put it on the chat rooms and then answer the hundreds of messages they'd be bombarded with right after it hit the airwaves. Let's not forget this all happened in the dog days of summer. when most people are at the beach or the lake, the camp, barbecues, family gatherings, getting a break from the daily grind. The last thing anyone is looking to do in August is stay indoors glued to their phone day and night. Many, like me, got involved because they knew a specific Afghan who was eligible to get out. Many did not. They put their life on hold in the sweltering heat of August because it was the right thing to do. They recognized that our American values were at stake and our government had inexplicably dropped the ball. So they would need to pick it up and run with it. Throughout August and beyond, Digital Dunkirk is credited with helping evacuate 124,000 Americans and Afghan allies. This is a record for a civilian airlift evacuation that probably won't be broken anytime soon. The fact a Hollywood remake of a movie about the original Dunkirk evacuation was a box office hit nearly 80 years after it happened is a testimony to how unique that mission was. It remains in the public consciousness because there haven't been too many examples in human history when the public gets to rescue the military. That wasn't the exact case in Kabul, but there was enough similarities to understand how the name Digital Dunkirk came about. Though the strategy and execution was much different than the original Dunkirk rescue in 1940, one thing remained the same: the human desire to help one another in a time of need. I think it's a much-needed reminder of what we can accomplish when we put our differences aside and just see each other as people unified by the principles of freedom, democracy, and honor. Hopefully people will still remember it happened 80 years from now. Chapter 1. At home in Michigan. It's a Sunday night in early October in Ypsilanti, Michigan. There's a chill in the air now, and the leaves have been dropping from the trees and swirling in the autumn gusts that come down from Canada like clockwork every year to signal the change of seasons. I've just come back from my friend Abdul's house, which means that I'm well fed and played out. Because another thing I can count on is that almost every Sunday evening I'm in town, I'll have eaten a platter of delicious Afghan food and played with the cutest kids this side of Kabul. I don't really have a choice in the matter. Refusing the hospitality of an Afghan is a high crime and misdemeanor, even if you're over there as much as I am. When you step foot in an Afghan house, you're treated like the most important person on the planet. I've learned to stop reflexively refusing and just accept it. When I explain our friendship, you might think I get preferential treatment because of it. But I guarantee that's not the case. I could have been some guy in a work release program from prison, and they'd treat me the same. When I arrived that evening, Abdul spoke the customary Afghan greeting by asking, "Brother, how's your family?" Afghans are obsessed with being polite and gracious hosts. "How's my family?" "My family is great, Abdul." I ask him the same, and he says they're fine, but I know that's not entirely true. I know that the culture shock of being here has been hard on all of them. He, his wife, and kids all have a new language to learn. He had to get a driver's license, and they all have had to learn new customs that are second nature to us. He has to work long hours to afford an apartment and pay for necessities. He's worried about his family back in Kabul and the misery the Taliban is inflicting on all of them he left behind. He wires money back from every paycheck because the economy has cratered in Kabul, and without it, they won't have enough to eat. I know he especially misses his younger brother, Masood, who hoped to come with him, but who got separated in the chaos at the airport. He prays that he'll see him again someday. But Abdul is alive. His children are growing. If all goes right with the immigration process still ahead, they'll make their way here and hopefully live the American dream like so many immigrants before them. We almost turned our backs on them. We almost shut the door in their faces, but thank God we didn't. Now we can tell the story of his journey and the journey of all the Afghans who managed to get out of Kabul. We can let people know that although the bright lights of the media have shifted to other conflicts and events, the effort still continues. We can give the 2-1 Marines who were there at Abbey Gate the chance to tell us in their own words what that was like. They're the ones who carry the physical and emotional scars of the experience. The rest of us are just bystanders. Finally, and most regrettably, we can do our best to honor the ultimate sacrifice of the 13 U.S. service members who died at Abbey Gate at Hekaya the day after Abdul Muhammad left. They are Staff Sergeant Darren Hoover, 2-1 Marines; Sergeant Johanny Rosario Picardo, 5th Marine Expeditionary Brigade.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?